Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Today's guest? Well, first let me tell you where I recorded today's episode. In Havana, Cuba. I was in Cuba for a few days as part of a small group of American reporters arranged in part by an organization called Cuba Educational Travel. And I met a number of journalists, including Christina Escobar, who's one of the main anchors of state-run television in Cuba. And after having an interesting conversation with her at a rooftop bar over a mojito, yeah, I was in Cuba, I ordered a mojito. I asked her if she'd be willing to talk about what we discussed in front of these microphones. She said yes. And I can tell you the conversation we had was as frank as the one we had over drinks. And in the background, you'll hear a little of the noise of Havana, including a dog that just wouldn't stop barking. Insanely, this was my second trip to Cuba. Covering Obama as president, I was actually one of the pool reporters on Air Force One when it landed in Havana last March. That was an insane trip, and it included the most insane press conference I ever went to, with two different people walking up on stage to whisper in Castro's ear while Obama was talking, Raul Castro arguing with the American reporters. But Christina surprised me. She wasn't there. You'll hear her explain why, and you'll hear us argue a little over how censorship works for state-run television. So take a listen, and if you'd like to get a better sense of how this all fits into the desperation, confidence, reassurance, and resignation that is Cuba these days since Trump announced the policy changes, look at the article I wrote up on our website with interviews from across the Cuban government and across Havana. But before you do, remember to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Guests coming up, Arnold Schwarzenegger, as well as former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, Alaska Governor Bill Walker, and many more. Follow me on Twitter and on Facebook at Isaac Dover, and keep those emails coming. There are great thoughts and feedback coming in. And now, my conversation with Christina Escobar, straight from Havana. When Obama came, I was at the press conference he did with Raul Castro, and it was a big moment for the people who worked for Obama. They kept talking about it for weeks afterwards. You weren't there. Why weren't you there?
Cuban journalists as a whole were not part of the delegation, and we knew there was going to be a public statement, but we didn't know that it was going to be a press conference, so I assumed that's the reason why we were not invited. And usually in the Cuban protocol, when the president is going to talk, journalists are invited to go. If not, well, you're not supposed to just stand outside on the door. It's kind of hard in that place to just knock on the door. So I believe that's the reason. I believe that the idea that the Cuban authorities had was that it was not going to be a press conference, but it turned out to be one.
So there were people in the half of the room was filled with people that the American journalists thought were Cuban journalists. Who do you think those people were?
No idea. I was not there. I know I had two colleagues there which work with the Cuban president, Raul Castro. But other than them, I don't even have a clue of who might that be. But then, usually Americans, and don't take this in the wrong way, tend to mirror every reality with your own. You assume that they were journalists. They were not even pretending to be journalists, probably, but you understood that we're journalists, we're a group, so we're here, so probably they are too.
In talking to people, as I said, in the White House then, the people around President Obama, they felt like that press conference would change things in Cuba, that it would tell people, this is what democracy, free, open press looks like, that it would put Raul Castro on TV answering questions, and that it would open up journalism. It's something that they did in a lot of countries where there are problems with open journalism in China and Ethiopia. Did it have any kind of effect like that?
Probably seeing Obama going to the baseball game or going to eat to a private restaurant, or descending from the plane stairs with Michelle Obama and giving his hand to help her, has had more effect on the Cuban people than that press conference.
Did it have effect on journalists? You're a journalist.
The effect on journalists is previous to the visit, and it's more I went out on the streets to ask people what they were expecting about Obama. And, of course, I read a lot of American media. And you read American media, and it's one world, and you talk to the people in Cuba, and it's another world. You read American media, it was all about human rights and democracy and freedom of speech and all of that. And you talk to people here in Cuba, and it's like, okay, lifting of the embargo, more visas, job opportunities, living in peace, being able to go and visit my family, and they would come here and visit us. So two different worlds. So the American media had a construction that they wanted to see on the expectations of the visit of the president, which were not real. And people did like that Obama would come and didn't welcome him, definitely. But the expectations were very differently. So that impact that you think is actually, and in journalism, I do believe that everything that happened after December 17th, 2014, changed the things in journalism. The first, and I don't want to do it personally, but usually the people that covered these issues were older men. And in December 17th, 2014, it was important to speak English, read, understand English, understand the political system, being able to understand the process of how decision-making happens in the U.S. from a more unbiased perspective and less about the traditional rhetoric around the hostility between the two countries. And for that, you needed different people.
But you still work for state-run media. So how does that, what does that mean in daily life in terms of your relationship with the Cuban government?
The first thing is that, for example, Fidel was very active with media. He talked a lot to journalists. He was around journalists a lot. He even had a show in which I worked that was developed.
You dealt with Fidel personally?
No, I graduated of journalism in 2011. He was already five years ago. So I saw him several times, but never in working.
What was he like in person?
I always saw him in public events. He was remarkable, impressive. The difference now, how it's different now, is that Raul talks to media less and appears on television less. I believe that has had an impact in the sense that we've been able to improvise more.
What does that mean? You can't say whatever you want, though, right? Or
can you say whatever you want?
I think I can.
You think you can?
Yeah.
I think I can, too. But I work for media. I work for I have a boss,
right?
Like you have, like any
but
other
my
journalist.
Boss, I mean, I can't say whatever I want. I have to answer to my boss, but my boss is not a member of the government.
But he's a private individual and has interests, too. The difference is
it's
that...
It's true, although I've been working at Politico for 6 years, and I've never heard from the person who owns the company about any individual story that I've written.
But you do know what's the agenda of Politico. You understand what are the priorities.
The priorities are to get the news out. I mean, there's no more priorities than that for us. We make Republicans mad, we make Democrats mad, we make independents mad. I've gotten hate emails from across the political spectrum and across
I've had hate emails too. From people in Miami, by the way.
But not from the government.
No.
I mean, I get people in the government yelling at me, whether they're people in the White House or in Congress or whatever it might be.
My experience is positive in the sense that I've never said anything that I don't believe in. I've been able to choose the field in which I want to be an expert. I've been sent abroad several times, having the opportunities of covering probably the most important news in our continent in the last 5 years. So in that sense, I've been privileged. Of course, not every day I agree with the agenda of my media. But I choose if I want to participate in that or not. And it's not a problem. It's fine. And I think that's a sense of freedom. And then, if I have a disagreement, I openly say that I have a disagreement.
And what happens then?
We talk about it. Sometimes I win, sometimes I don't win, but it's a positive dialogue. And that's happening every day more in the Cuban media. And there are tensions around media, and that's important. When I was growing up, all we had to watch was the news show at 8 p.m. I was in the middle of the special period. We had electricity 8 hours and 8 hours not. So that's it. That's news. 8 p.m., no internet, no nothing. I'm talking about the beginnings of the 90s. Now, we have every day more access to internet on the parks, on the streets, on workplaces, at the university. We have El Paquete, which probably you've heard of, which is extremely interesting experience, the Cuban Netflix, disconnected Netflix with all stolen copyrights.
And that works by people who you go to somebody's house, basically, and they give you a drive.
It's like a dealer.
Yeah.
You go to his place or he goes to your place and he brings...
But it's a dealer for Game of Thrones.
For Game of Thrones, for Modern Family, for House of Cards, for Stephen Colbert Show or Jimmy Fallon. What Jimmy Fallon, Saturday Night Live.
And you get to choose what you get or the dealer chooses for you?
It's a terabyte of information. Impossible to watch in a week. So usually the people that get the whole thing, I choose what to watch. But it's there. Now at 8 p.m., you can choose to plug your USB to your television or to your digital box decoder and be watching, I don't know, Speechless or Friends or Sex and the City. I don't know, whatever you want to watch. And not watch the news show. And then internet. And then the fact that people travel more. So there's not a monopoly of entertainment or information of the government on the people.
What happens in times when... Have you gotten in trouble for things that you've said on the air ever?
Not
big. Do you hear
from
them after? What happens?
For example, I remember once that I made this story about the future of Cuban democracy. And I don't know... Nothing happened. No one called. I expected to call. I expected someone to...
Did you do it to see how far you could push it?
No, I did it because I enjoyed it. Because I interviewed this great intellectual, very controversial, by the way. And he speaks his mind. And I didn't want to cut a piece of it. And I aired the entire thing on prime time.
And you didn't have an editor who said to you, don't do it?
It was
but aired. The call didn't come on that. But there have been times when a call came?
For example, I remember other time in which I interviewed this very important journalist, which is the first woman to enter a baseball dugout in Cuba. And I asked her why Cuba is worse in international sports events. And she told me openly, because Fidel is not around. And Cuba is a very sports country, important for us to win. And when you say that the reason why we're not winning is that Fidel is not around, it's considered a criticism.
Fidel is not around because he wasn't going to the games? Or?
Because he was not the president anymore.
So
because it was not a priority for the government anymore.
Okay. So because he had transferred to Raul?
Because
Raul
we had a different president with different priorities.
Is that true?
It's true.
Is it true that that affected why Cuba wasn't winning games?
Of course. That's one of the reasons. The special period was a severe crisis that had a tremendous effect on all the infrastructure, the base sports movement that we had. But that was part of the reason. And Raul had other priorities, which is fine too. Priorities, by the way, essentials for the reproduction, for the sustaining of the revolution. But that's big. I mean, for our standards, saying that could be considered criticism. And I did from colleagues, it's like, that's kind of strong that you say that. Why is that strong? Is it a lie? Is it bad?
But not from a boss, ever?
No, not from a boss. I'm feisty. I mean, I respect my bosses very much. I'm very responsible to what I said. About what I say, I prepare myself. I don't go around saying things without being able to explain and defend what I'm doing in critical moments, like after the speech of Obama in the theater, or after John Kerry's speech when the opening of the embassy, or after Fidel died. I've been on camera live, no prompter, just explaining to the people what just happened. And I've succeed in every occasion. I don't think I'm that special. I just think that I try to be responsible with what I say. And I think that has created a sense that if you want to tell me that I can't say something, or do you want to scold me because I said something irresponsible, it's going to be a hard conversation.
What I think some people might hear from that is that you do self-censorship, that you keep yourself from getting into trouble.
That happens too.
Yeah.
That happens too. It depends on the point of view. Self-censorship for you, it might be for me responsibility.
Responsibility to whom?
Towards the audience. I think the biggest problem of journalism in the world and in Cuba too is towards who we compromise, towards who we made a commitment to. And I was taught that journalism is a public service, that giving journalism to private interests doesn't ensure that it's actually going to be a good journalism. And remember, too, that you can't compare Cuba to the U.S. Compare Cuba to Haiti, to Mexico, to Nicaragua, to Venezuela, not even to Venezuela, which is a rich country. Think about the context in which Cuba is. The examples that we have around doesn't mean that private media is the way to go in order to have decent journalism that actually makes politicians accountable of their actions. That's not the only way.
Do you think that Raul Castro and the government are accountable for their actions?
They are. They do. But not in the way that you usually understand it in the American political
scenario.
Well,
so in what way?
Well, National Assembly. He speaks, he receives questions, he makes self-criticism. When he started his administration officially, he developed these guidelines of how the economy should change. And he stood in front of the people and said, okay, this is wrong. We need to take another path and solve a bunch of problems because we're in a bad crisis. And he had a popular national discussion of what people cared about. And everyone in your neighborhood, in your school, in your workplace, you talked, you said what you wanted. That was all together. And then that was the guidelines. Those guidelines, for example, allowed Cubans to have a migration reform that allowed Cubans to travel more freely. And also, for example, the fact that Cuban Americans or Cubans who are abroad can come back and repatriate and they don't lose property, which was a problem. The fact that internet is more open is also part of that policy. It's a policy in which, okay, we're doing something wrong, there are people in disagreement, and we need to change that. Still, in this new program that they announced, development program for 2030, they have a specific chapter on that, on how people from the government officials need to be more accountable of what they do.
And you think they're held to it? You feel like they
no,
are?
No, they're not doing it. They're okay. Not doing it.
So they're not accountable?
I mean, there are systems for that.
Yeah.
But if you ask me as a citizen, there are systems for that. Sometimes worse, sometimes not. As a journalist, they don't. I mean, if you ask me, it's practically impossible. Getting a source is tremendously hard in Cuba. We say that every day. I have a talk show about media, aired 7 p.m. every Monday. And we say that in every show every week. I mean, on national television, public national, state-run, state-paid, everything. And we say that every day. And it's like, so what? No one's listening to us. And getting sources is practically impossible because they don't want to face media. And they don't feel the need to do it. And that's something that needs to change immediately.
Do you think it will?
I think it will. I mean, it's a matter of time.
But not immediately. Immediately is
immediately, not tomorrow, no. Next year, maybe.
The night that Fidel Castro died, you were the one who was on the air. You grew up in Cuba. You lived in Cuba your whole life. Fidel Castro is a figure that I don't know that any American can understand the relationship that a Cuban has to Fidel Castro, especially that you were born after the revolution. What is that like being on the air that night when you're trying to report it and trying to speak about it in a way that you feel is being frank, but also is respectful in a state-run television station about Fidel Castro? Obviously, you've got your own thoughts about what's going on.
That was a night of mixed feelings. We were not prepared for that.
Even though he'd been sick for so long?
New York Times had the dossier prepared. CNN, too. We were not prepared. At least that I know of. And I'm not exactly an uninformed person. The good thing is that he just went 90. The big birthday on August. So we had a bunch of material prepared about him turning 90. But we were not prepared. And in a way, we were naive. And I think I could also use the word unprofessional because that was going to happen. And I mean, it's obvious it was going to happen. You need to be prepared for that. But even talking about it, it was like, we don't talk about it. And it was a mistake. The problem is that when you stand up there, you're not ready for that.
Because the BBC, there was an article about this a couple of months ago, they have a whole plan of what will happen when Queen Elizabeth dies, which will happen at some point. And there, that's the BBC. It's a somewhat different relationship than you have with the Cuban government. But
We should have had one. And actually, I've said that after meetings with bosses.
That so that it, for at some point, Raul Castro will die.
We should be ready for that, because that's going to happen and deserves a good coverage of saying all the things that he did during his life.
So other than being unprepared, was it a difficult night to be on camera?
Well, terribly difficult, because it's impossible not to make it personal too. I grew up watching him. My parents both worked for the state. They're psychologists, one of them. Both of them, a shift in life, all the earth shift, because of the revolution triumphed. And in a way, so did I, because they achieved things, so I was able to do it. There's a link between patriotism and Fidel, of love to your homeland and revolution. And without him, revolution would never have happened like it happened. So everything that I like about my country is related in a way with him, with what he did.
And
a lot of things,
everything you don't like also.
And
right?
A lot of things that I don't like too, because that's the thing when you're in power 50 years. So some people are in power four and they're remembered by their mistakes. Can you imagine when you're 50? But in any case, and that's interesting, even he did make a lot of mistakes and things that I, now that I see, and this should have been different, because we are suffering consequences of decisions that were made. And I, even in that scenario, in which you are objective enough to see that he was a human being, it was a tremendously sad night. And losing him put us in a situation in which we didn't know what was going to happen. But we were already in the so-called post-Castro era already.
And you had to be the one on air trying to explain that to people.
I had to be on air. And then in the Plaza de la Revolución, when the people came like in a big motorcade to express their feelings towards Fidel, I had to interview people. I was on the air practically for hours, for 2 days that happened before the ashes went to Santiago. And I confess you that I didn't measure well how much political capital Fidel had. Because time has passed, 10 years outside of the power, problems and people, there are people that really like Raul, there are people that don't like Raul because they miss Fidel, and this contradiction. But you know, you might believe that his image or his influence might have faded.
But his picture's all over the place. I didn't even get through passport control before I saw the first Fidel Castro picture.
Welcome to Cuba. In any case, I saw 17 years old. What's the kind of link that a 17 years old person might have with Fidel? And they were crying like they
were
lost.
Were you crying?
I cried when I could. I was working all the time. But I did cry. And essentially because I saw how people suffered. I remember.
You cried because people were crying about Fidel Castro, not because you were emotional yourself?
I didn't have time to be emotional. I knew that he died. I called to my station. Okay, it's true. And I started picking black clothes to be on camera. I passed from knowing to what I'm supposed to do now, because I work in a public media. Television is the most influential media in Cuba. 96% of homes have a TV. So, and that's why I work where I work, because if you want to change something, it's very comfortable to be in a blog or to be on a music show 11 p.m. in a radio station. But if you want to get into trouble, if you want to change things, you have to be in the front line. And the front line is television. So I pass from knowing to what I'm supposed to do now. I have to go there. And I didn't want to see a coverage of speeches, of apologetic stories. I wanted to see a respectful, not only to him, but to the people. Because Fidel is Fidel, but Fidel is no one without the Cuban people. And that link of masses towards that man is the reason why all of this is so peculiar, even after 10 years being outside of the power.
So I want to close with this. You report on the American-Cuban relationship and the future of it. What is the reporting that you're doing about President Trump, the changes that he's announced and about what's going on in American politics overall at this point?
Covering the elections, these last elections, has been probably the hardest thing that I've had to explain to the Cuban audience. Because even though I do admire how Americans, all that scenario, all that show works, I believe it shows a respect for the voters. It showed, I believe, a deterioration of the American political culture and a deterioration of the leaders or the politicians that supposed to represent the status quo. Specifically after Obama, which was a pretty decent man. So it was tremendously difficult. Nevertheless, no one told me, but I understood that the approach was to give Trump the benefit of the doubt. Okay, he's the president. When Fidel Castro died, the only world leader that had a disrespectful approach towards that was Donald Trump. Even Mariano Rajoy, which is not precisely a fan of Fidel, had a respectful approach. Even Obama, with his common ambiguity, came on with a message, respectful at least, for a lot of audiences.
Obama said something, he had a statement that didn't really say anything. That was
right,
the way
but
they
that's
did it.
Very Obama on Cuba. I expected that, but it was fine. I mean, it's.
But Trump started tweeting about
Obama Fidel. Is the best we can expect from the American policy towards Cuba. We need to be objective on that. I mean, and I try to explain that here too. I mean, don't expect him to be, he's as good as he can be for us, as representing what he represents.
So how do you report on what Trump is saying about Cuba?
Well, only being informative is strong enough. We tried to cover only the news, trying not to editorialize much. Essentially because we've been giving him wiggle room to see what he was going to do.
So there was the benefit of the doubt from when he was elected through in December when Fidel died and he responded as he did.
The thing is, no, he was elected, then that Fidel died, he was not in office. So it was him talking on Twitter. We understand that he's not a rational person on Twitter, so he tends to be very emotional. So he thinks that, so I think it was wise of the Cuban government and of ourselves to not just go alone with the last wave of emotion of the president. So let's wait to see what's going to happen, what's going to do.
Benefit of the doubt through January 20th or through June?
Through June. Okay, we're covering him. It's going to be a coverage focused on information which is weird. Usually, the understanding was that the next American president will maintain the embargo. It's going to be bad. So after this benefit of the doubt, in which he demonstrated he was going to do what I expected that he was going to do, even worse, I think. What I explained, I came on Cuban National Television to explain the speech for some. It was a big show to link with a very old community of Cubans which do not represent the Cuban-American community in the U.S., and then trying to create a link with Marco Rubio, a questionable senator, a Cuban that we're not proud of, which he's not exactly Cuban. Probably you that have been twice in Cuba knows more about Cuba than Marco Rubio because he's never been around. And shows again that Trump has an agenda which is not only good for the U.S., because having this hostility with Cuba doesn't give any benefit to the U.S. as a country.
If he came here, how would the trip be covered? You covered the Obama trip here.
It's hard to imagine a situation that is so unlikely to happen.
Would Cubans want to see Donald Trump in Havana?
No. No. He wouldn't be welcome. Because he's been very disrespectful. You know, every child in every culture, you grow up with a poem or a song. The poem through which I grew up, the one that I said and my friends said in every public event, it was a poem about a girl that lost her parents in the Bay of Pig invasion. And it's a tremendously well-written poem and extremely sad. So it's part, it's entrenched in our culture to understand that that was a savage, imperialistic invasion. And then, 6 years after, you have this president in a theater with the name of one of the mercenaries that came in that invasion, in front of those mercenaries, saying that they were the true Cubans that were going to bring freedom to Cuba. What? I mean, I was born in 1987. That has nothing to do with me. And I'm the future of Cuba is in my shoulders, of my generation. That has nothing to do. He was disrespectful to the Cuban history, showed again that he's bad advised, that the people that are around him doesn't know a thing about history, and they're a very Cold War way of thinking approach, which doesn't work anymore in Latin America. And Obama proved that. And I don't think Obama did that because he wanted to. I think he did that because it was good for the American interests. And it was good for us too. And we took advantage of that. But we don't have to agree. American interests are not Cuban interests. But okay, we can have a middle ground in which we both can win something. And Trump erased that. And that's not good for the international image of the U.S., neither for the influence of Latin America, and doesn't bring any good unless...
But you still have hope that things will get better in the way that you want them to? Your face says no.
I am not very hopeful. But
usually we try to end these on a somewhat of an up note, but I don't know that we can do that, Christina.
I think there's a lot of disagreement and tension in the U.S., because of the political situation. And I, not because I'm Cuban, but I do believe Cuba is part of that. Because undoing everything that the previous president did doesn't make it right. And that's exactly, you might disagree with Obamacare, you might disagree with the climate change agreement, but that, first of all, undoing it doesn't make it right, and on Cuba much less. So I think the hope that I feel is you come in here and stop searching for sources about Cuba in Miami. That's not a source. It's irresponsible. It's biased. It's not
it's
good.
It's biased here, too.
But first of all, you're going to talk about Cuba. Don't go to Miami.
No, that's fair. But to say, I mean, everybody
in the first, everyone has a bias. If you want to talk about Washington, I talk to you, you're going to have a bias. And you work in Washington, so it's fine. The thing is not having a bias. The thing is that if you're going to talk about Cuba, don't talk to Marco Rubio.
You have to find everybody's biases.
That's why we need to break that wall that is not physical, but it's right there, in order to understand that there's not such a war, and Cuba is not a lighter version of North Korea that they want to frame us like. I didn't grow up in that country. The country that Trump talked about in that speech is not the country I live in. Has nothing to do with me.
All right, Christina, thanks for taking the time.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks, as always, to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy, who did not get to come to Havana with me. Too bad for her. We'll get her there next time. And our intern, Rachel Cusick. Remember, subscribe, rate us on Apple Podcasts, whatever platform you're using. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Deval Patrick, Bill Walker, Maz Jobrani, many more coming up. Catch you next time.